From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Sanjiv Bhattacharya says the world of polygamy has been like a range of volcanoes, seldom acknowledged except when there's an eruption, a scandal like the stories of abuse or a standoff with the law or the saga of the polygamist cult leader Warren Jeffs, who's of course now on trial. And Bhattacharya admits this is the part that first got him interested in exploring plural marriage. But after he traveled to communities of polygamists to talk to them, he found a surprising amount of diversity. In his new book, which is funny and surprisingly personal, he attempts to show a fuller picture of the secret lives of these people. Today in the program, he'll join us to talk about what he's learned about the hidden world of Mormon polygamy. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's probably true that most people will always see polygamy and those who practice it as strange or creepy. But the writer and journalist Sanjiv Bhattacharya says lately the winds have been turning, that more and more people are feeling more and more tolerant or at least interested. In his new book, he says pop culture has come around. Just look at the popularity of the HBO drama Big Love, he says, and you can see it's no longer cool to throw rocks at polygamists. Bhattacharya says he saw an opening, a time when all this interest has come, he might be able to get into this hidden world of prophets and harems of secrets and wives before the window closes again. And so his book, which is funny and surprisingly personal, is an attempt to show a fuller picture of the secret lives of these people. Today in the program, Sanjiv Bhattacharya is joining us to talk about his book. It's called Secrets and Wives, The Hidden World of Mormon Polygamy. We invite you to join us if you like, if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Sanjiv Bhattacharya is the U.S. correspondent for British Esquire. His work has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, Marie Claire, GQ, among other publications. In 2006, he produced a documentary about Warren Jeffs for Channel 4 in the U.K. Secrets and Wives is his first book, and he's joining us from a studio in Los Angeles where he's based. Sanjiv Bhattacharya, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Doug. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I guess we should start with the words that you chose, words that you admit in the book are, you know, packed with meaning and history, and people are really sensitive about all of this. I wanted to say, I mentioned in a promo to the show the subtitle, The Hidden World of Mormon Polygamy, and someone called to say that there was no such thing as Mormon polygamy. Of course, the LDS Church stopped practicing it more than 100 years ago. But talk about your use of that term, because you say you're using Mormon in a way that's sort of broader than normal.
Well, I think it's telling that this is even an issue for the LDS Church, because, I mean, I understand that what the Church's position is, they no longer practice polygamy and therefore there's no such thing as Mormon polygamy. But to try to control the meaning of a word and exercise a kind of proprietorial rights over what the word Mormon means is it's verging on Orwellian, if you ask me. I don't think churches get to decide what words mean, thank heaven. And I think that the word Mormon relates to, the way I understand it, it relates to the history of the religion, the way in which the word has been used, the meanings that have been attached to it over the years, just the way that words accrue meaning. Mm. And I think that the fundamentalists of Utah, people who practice polygamy now, absolutely consider themselves Mormon, and they have every reason to, I believe.
What about cult? You use that word a bit in the book.
I know that cult has a sort of a derogatory connotation about it, and I accept that. But when I use the word cult in the book, I am talking about many of the aspects that are very critical of small fringe extremist religious groups, and that's what we're talking about here. I think it's easy to be very sort of liberal and tolerant about groups that are not liberal and tolerant at all, and I'm not inclined to do that in this case. I mean, I think most of us know a cult when we see one, and I saw a lot in Utah.
I want to ask you about your interest in religion, which you've actually described, I think, as an obsession. What is it about religion in particular, do you think, that interests you?
Well, you know, I sort of, I had a phase, something I sort of wrote about in the book, that, you know, it was a yearning. I think everybody has a yearning at some point in their lives. But in my case, I look back on it now because it has since dissipated, as a kind of yearning for identity as much as anything else. You know, I think that when, you know, as you grow up, you see, you know, bad things happen to good people, and it's hard to look in the face. And my yearning sort of was rooted in this kind of wish for a God who could see what a good person I was and would somehow reward me for my sort of private goodness. But when I reached out for religion, I sort of grabbed what was closest culturally, you know, and it was as somebody from Indian parents growing up in England, I always felt a little bit like an outsider.
Yeah.
And so Hinduism sort of fitted. It was something that I could sort of make my own. It would confirm my specialness, you know, in England. And I was kind of quite gung-ho about it for a while. You know, I embraced all that stuff about magic and miracles, which is what I think you have to do to be genuinely religious. But
last. Well, what's most interesting about that is that you included it all in a book like this. I mean, I wanted you to say something about the style of the book, because this is not just a first-person, you know, reportage. It's not someone – it's personal. Not exactly a memoir, of course, although – you do share parts of yourself in the book. And talk about why you wanted to do that, because there's a section here I want you to read which sort of talks about how you were, you know, casting about for, as you say, some sort of spiritual identity.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't something that I immediately set out to do. It's something that sort of emerged as a way to thread the various narratives of this book together. Because when I set out to cover this world, and I was actually in Utah doing my research, my original goal was to just to cover the whole world of polygamy in all its different sort of facets. Yeah. And I was kind of searching for a thread to weave it all together. And given my experiences, it became pretty clear that, you know, as an outsider interacting with this society, the way in which I was treated often said a lot about the subjects. Mm. You know, it said a lot about the groups. You know, were they welcoming? Were they hostile? Were they paranoid? Were they warm? Their approach to me was quite illuminating. And so that was the first way that I became the thread of the story. And it sort of dawned on me that the kind of very, very personal debates and discussions I was having, I was doing that sort of impertinent journalist thing where you go and meet a stranger and start asking them incredibly personal questions. Right. And after a while, you sort of, I found that in all of these conversations I was having, I was also giving a lot of myself. Yeah. And there were, in the development of trust and understanding, that's a natural thing to do. And I thought, why would I leave that out of a book like this when we're talking about subjects that are very difficult to be objective about? You know, religion really touches on a very deep and personal place in people's lives. And why would I exempt myself from that? It seemed sort of dishonest in a way.
There's this moment where you're talking with Anne Wild, whom we'll come to know a little bit later in the program. She's an advocate for polygamous lifestyle, I suppose, trying to sort of correct the misimpressions that people have about it all. But there's this moment where you tell her a very personal story about the fact that your parents, it was an arranged marriage. And yeah, it helped her kind of relate to you, you say, in an important way.
Yeah, I was a peculiar animal, you know, investigating this world. I was a strange creature knocking on the doors of fundamentalists. They didn't really know what to make of me. and I can't blame them, you know. I have Indian parents. I'm English. I have one wife. but I'm married and I don't have any children. That's kind of peculiar. And the accent doesn't fit the way that I look. And I'm an atheist, which is bizarre. And these are people also that are very welded to their ancestry and their religion and their roots. you know, at great cost in many ways. And yet I couldn't be further from mine. You know, my parents moved from India to England. I moved from England to America, and I've lived in India for a little while. So I'm kind of all over the place. But I think, you know, there are aspects of my strangeness that actually worked, because one of the other things that Anne told me was that she might be a bit more tentative were I, for example, a dyed-in-the-wool Christian, because then my views on religious matters might be a bit more prejudicial. Or were I a Mormon, for example, then she might have had very different questions for me. But the fact that my parents had an arranged marriage and that they didn't get to decide who they married was I could see her eyes light up. It was like, oh, that's something that we do have in our culture. And if you're okay with that, then that makes you unusual.
Well, I want to have you read this section, if you don't mind, because I think it gives us a sense of the way it's written, which is there's a kind of lovely irreverence to it. I have to say it's really funny. We should make that point, I think, as well. But also, this is a terrific moment where you talk about you're looking for identity, looking for a club, I think is how you put it. And the Hindu saints sort of offered saints that looked more like you. Do we need to say anything more to set this part up?
I don't think so. You're very kind. I appreciate your kind comments, Doug, I have to say. I'll just read, shall I?
Please.
So little by little, I morphed from what I imagined was a rootless enigma to what I imagined was a Bengali Hindu. I fooled myself that I did have a people after all, and some of them had magic powers. All the stuff about the material world being an illusion and life and death being a cycle, that was all well and good, but I was in it for the superpowers. Just as Mormons aim to be gods and Christians yearn for heaven, every morning I would crunch my legs into an excruciating half lotus and follow my breath in and out, chanting mantras. I even tried them in Sanskrit as a kind of incantation, trying to be a still pond, a stoic in the face of good fortune as bad. But progress was slow. I couldn't tune out the chatter. I'd scold myself for losing focus and then scold myself for scolding myself. But still, I believed I saw the Creator's hand in all things, even rifling through the thoughts in my head. It was a comfort to know that my private morality was being noticed, that there was order and fairness to the universe. Faith made me less fearful. It reassured me that a mighty force was guiding all things, and I felt less distant from others. I like to imagine a small, eternal candle burning within us all, a reminder that we are all one spirit. It's a puny hallmark image, I know, but I recognize it now as a salve for the loneliness I felt as a somewhat shy teenager. Prayer was, in some ways, a simulacrum of company. But I took comfort in my little candle, and I took it with me to India in my early 20s, where for the best part of a year, I roamed the country hoping for transcendence, that moment that I'd read about in the non-fiction section of the library, in which I'd be able to see in all directions at once, and for an instant, be one with the entire grand swirl of creation.
Of course, then you write about your faith begins to falter, and you mention in 2001 how it fell away for good, and I just wonder, what effect did that experience, having faith, having lost faith, how did it affect the way you reported the story and the way you dealt with all of it again? Again, maybe helped you just relate to it more?
Well, you know, I think that it affected it in the sense that religion became kind of a bit of a void that in my life that needed to be explored all the more. Yeah. In a strange way, while I was nurturing my little candle, I didn't question as much. I was reassured by it. I thought, you know, that's fine. There is a God, and everything is working according to the way that it more or less says in the books. And so I had there was an extent to which I stopped thinking about it. Mm. But once those things disappeared, then I was left with a sense of emptiness, I'll be honest, but not desperation, more curiosity. And so when I came to America in 2000, when George W. Bush's presidency was just beginning, and, you know, to come from England to America, it's impossible not to be fascinated by the religious life. I mean, in England, God is more like a sort of an afterthought, you know. It's a library book that hasn't been returned or something. It's not a topic that is going to inflame people. And yet, you know, in 2000 especially, fundamentalism was very much in the air, you know. Islamic fundamentalism was on the rise, about to change the world, and there was the rise of the religious right was deforming all kinds of debates and issues in America. And so my fascination with fundamentalism was, you know, all the more. And of all of them, Mormon fundamentalism really stood out, because of all the religions in America, Mormonism just seemed the most quintessentially American.
It's interesting you write about how the Warren Jeff story, for example, and that community gave you a kind of clarity. You say that it was exciting. I think exciting is the word you use, in fact, that you had found the story about this community that existed not only outside of society but also outside of the law. That was part of the appeal, I guess, for you.
Yeah, I mean, I still find it astonishing, you know, when I remember that there's this population of the number that's bandied around is about 40,000 now, fundamentalists, and I think that's more than it was. But nevertheless, you know, fundamentalism has prospered and prevailed for over 100 years in open defiance of the law. And that I don't know, in a way that actually gives me hope. You know, that this isn't such a homogenous society in which, you know, change in individuality is not possible. I mean, look at the fundamentalists.
I wonder what your illusions were about, you know, finding the truth of all of this early on and how that changed. I mean, there's this story you tell right at the beginning, or certainly near the beginning of the book anyway, where you go to Colorado City, which is, of course, on the border of Arizona and Utah, and it's called Short Creek, Hilldale in Colorado City. It's this polygamous community, well-known around here. And you go into this, it's not a coffee shop, I guess it's a cafe, the Vermilion Cafe is the name of it, and you talk about feeling incredibly conspicuous and, well, not welcome at all, kind of a hostile. And I wonder what sort of sense that gave you about what this is going to be like now, this venture to try to find out about these people.
Yeah, there was a hostility wasn't isolated to that incident, I have to say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, there were a few examples. The reason I started with that episode was because it shone a light on exactly how conspicuous and different I was, and mm-hmm. and that this was in many ways I was entering a world that didn't really accept outsiders, and that if they were going to do that, it would be a new and difficult process. I wasn't just thrown out of the cafe. I was thrown out of somebody's house.
Right.
I was had some sort of reasonably heated arguments, but that's one side of it. The other side of it was very different. I mean, in Centennial Park, I lived there for months. I had fundamentalists coming over for chicken curry dinners. It was a very different atmosphere.
I wanted to ask you about what you wanted. You talk about it being a fuller picture. One of the things you ask also is, you ask yourself one of these questions, not only how people live and work, but are they like me, was a question you said you were kind of interested in.
Yes. In a sort of basic and fundamental way. There's a lot that's been said more and more these days, given the debt ceiling fiasco, the impossibility of people who are different getting along. And this seemed to be a great way to try and sort of bridge a gap, because in many ways I couldn't be more different. But you always expect a reasonableness of the people that there will be a bedrock of consensus and agreement and kindness, and that we have similar values in common ultimately, although we may express them in different ways. I mean, these are the hopes that we all carry with us, I think. And I have to say, in many cases, that I was reassured. You know, there are many people that I met in fundamentalism who were very, very different to Warren Jeffs. And this is one of the interesting things about polygamy at this point in time. I mean, it's capturing the headlines at both poles of its spectrum.
Yeah.
And on one side, it's trying to achieve decriminalization, and on the other, it's there's a very lurid trial of an awful sex criminal. So this is the kind of spectrum I'm trying to kind of depict in my book. It's not one thing. It's many, many things.
Sanjiv Bhattacharya is with us. He's the author of the book Secrets and Wives, The Hidden World of Mormon Polygamy. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist Sanjiv Bhattacharya. He's joining us to talk about his new book called Secrets and Wives, The Hidden World of Mormon Polygamy. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call from Paul, who's joining us from Provo, Utah. Paul, welcome.
Thank you. I got most of my question answered in the commentary a minute ago, but I'll just ask the rest of my question. I'm curious to know how, in your book, you have come to feel, I guess, qualified or educated enough in your research.
Paul, I'm going to jump in there and put you on hold for a minute, and we're going to see if we can get a better connection, because I have no clue where you were going with that, and it's not your fault. It's your phones. Sanjiv, we'll come back to that if you don't mind. Let me ask, sure. Among the people that you talk to for some perspective are the people that you call the campaigners, people who are, of course, terribly opposed to the polygamous life and those who are supportive of it. I want to ask you about Vicky Prunty. She's a woman somewhat familiar to those of us here in Utah, appeared in the
yes.
media from time to time on stories about polygamy. Anyway, for Prunty, polygamy is, of course, more than just having men just having more than one wife, you say. She sees it as this whole culture of oppression. Talk about your experience with Vicky Prunty.
Well, you know, Vicky as an individual is, she's a very nice lady. She helped me a great deal writing the book. And she clearly has a personal history that has wounded her. There's several episodes of her life that, you know, we go into together in the book that have left scars, and I think it's evident that she feels wounded in the way that she frames this topic. But at the same time, you know, I have to give her credit. What has happened in the polarization of this argument is that you have campaigners that are kind of quite extreme on either side.
Yeah.
The way in which polygamy is framed within the bubble of those who talk about it on a daily basis is, are you pro-polygamy or are you anti-polygamy?
Mm.
And I don't think it's as straightforward as all that. Vicky is ardently anti-polygamy, and there are many who are with her who see polygamy as inherently oppressive to women,
right.
Inherently denigrates their value in society, and by its very essence leads to the victimization of underage girls. And they have many good reasons for saying exactly that sort of thing. But on the other side, of course, you have families like the Brown family on Sister Wives,
mm-hmm.
Many similar families whom I met on my travels, who would take very strong issue with that, because that's not the way that their lives are, and it's not the way that the lives of their neighbors are, and therefore they treat it as a slur, and immediately the guards go up on both sides. And I think the useful ground is in the middle. It's in the shades of gray, and that's why my position is somewhere in the middle. I think I've upset both sides, you know, because What I want to see is decriminalization of polygamy, because even while accepting that it is a very dysfunctional and warped culture, but I think that the most constructive path that we can take, given that polygamy is not going to go anywhere, is to decriminalize, because it benefits the victims of the culture, people who are trapped in these cults and are victims of people like Warren Jeffs. If you remove the fear of prosecution, then they feel liberated to go and seek help from the outside and to provide evidence and so on, and the bad guys can be put away.
You know, it's what's interesting about the story of Vicky Prunty and others, and all of them, I have to say, is you go in and you tell these stories that, and they have, all of them have these kind of sort of complicated elements to their lives. I mean, at one moment, Vicky seems like this tough-talking, resilient advocate for women, you know, who've been impressed. And then another moment, she says things that are just hard to believe, like about extraterrestrials and these grand conspiracies. It's a really interesting portrait.
Yes, there is a germ of religion very much still in her, in which she's prepared to accept things that are clearly unprovable, and there's an element of a dream life that she's still sort of reaching for, I think, or she was at that time. I think she may have changed. One thing that I've noticed is a lot of people who have emerged from the fundamentalist lifestyle, it takes them a while, but ultimately they end up in a position very much like the position that I'm in, which, you know, I would proudly define as atheist. Yeah. My foundation is doubt that we don't know everything rather than we do. And but it can be an uncomfortable ride and a kind of a scenic route to get to that point. But it's very gratifying to see that that is the path that people take when they leave these cultures.
It's very interesting the way people listened to your story. And they listened, but for a bit. I think it's about Anne. She asks you about being an atheist, and you know, you tell some personal parts of your life, and as you put it in the book, a few quick strokes, and then their curiosity is satisfied. But you say what they mostly wanted to hear was not about your life, but what you thought about them, how you saw them. That seemed to be kind of the obsession for all of the people you talked to. What did you think about us?
Yes, absolutely. This is part of the. The climate of one of the characteristics of fundamentalists is an acute sense of persecution. Mm. And outsiders like myself are viewed reflexively with suspicion. And because fundamentalism sort of exists on its own as a sort of a separatist culture in which... a them and us mentality is fostered from the outset. And I think the law plays a part in that, but I don't think it's the only reason. I think there's something very satisfying about being separated from the rest of the world, and that fundamentalism feeds on that as well. But I think that sort of separatist culture is sort of very unhealthy, and it leads to sort of a self-obsession where their interest in what's going on outside their bubble is really very scant. They're not really that interested. What's happening outside of fundamentalism is that people outside are persecuting them, and it doesn't really go much further than that in many ways.
Talk about Anne Wilde. She's another person that some people, again, around here would be somewhat familiar with. She started this fundamentalist response to groups like Vicky Prunty's group. She wants to show what she calls the sympathetic side to polygamy. She's an interesting character, strong in many ways, devout. What did you make of Anne Wilde?
Well, you know, I have to say I had my differences with Anne Wilde. She was very hospitable and very kind, and she's not somebody that I would ever speak badly about. But we did have some quite strong differences of opinion. I think that her own personal story is let's say not exactly the kind of background that one would expect for a campaigner for the polygamist lifestyle.
Yeah.
It has very strong contradictions, and these are well known in the world of fundamentalism, and that has damaged her credibility over the years. But that aside, my difference with her really came down to a group called The Order,
right.
Which is led by Paul Kingston. And I investigate The Order as deeply as possible. The chapter goes for over 100 pages. This is a story that is told in Utah periodically when there is a problem, when one of these volcanoes goes off.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
the rest of the time, it's very much ignored. And she Anne Wilde and many of the people on the Principal Voices side essentially serve as apologists for The Order. And there's some terrible things happening in The Order. According to former members of the group, this is a group that practices incest as doctrine.
Yeah.
Babies are born deformed and buried in the backyard. I mean, without a word to the authorities, there's child labor. The allegations against The Order and the prophet Paul Kingston are every bit as disturbing as those against Warren Jeffs. And yet, Warren Jeffs is the household name, not Paul Kingston. I think that there's something dishonest about Principal Voices when they go to bat for groups that are transparently as bad as The Order.
You went, as you said, to Centennial Park, which you write about, and you talk about how your skepticism there ebbs and flows. It's sort of this catalog of Mormon living. And the comparison often comes up that fundamentalists are like the Amish. But you write about that. You say one woman, I think it was Ruth is what you called her anyway, told you that the Amish, she said this, the Amish are quaint. We don't get quaint.
I thought that was a great quote, actually. Yes, I sympathize with that. You know, I do sympathize with that because I think the fictions that we create in our heads, the impressions of the Amish that we have, are really ultimately no less informed or no more informed than our suspicions of people in long dresses in Centennial Park. But Centennial Park is particularly suffering from an association with the FLDS.
Yeah.
You know, they're just down the road. They both used to be one group, and then Centennial Park broke away, which is what always happens. Groups are always breaking off. But because they're just down the road and because they essentially look and dress the same, they're from the same sort of culture, they get tarred with the same brush, and it galls them. But Centennial Park were very warm to me. So when I say my skepticism ebbed and flowed, I think that I was very much shown a side of polygamy in their life that they wanted to project because they want to change their image. They don't want the FLDS image. I mean, who does? But at the same time, they were very warm to me. You know, they left the keys in the flower pot,
right,
and I could come and go as I pleased.
There's the sense that they want to be perceived as diverse. And as you say, I'm sure that's true. But it's also true that you write about that, like they're fairly conservative in their political ideology. They watch Fox, you write, and vote Republican pretty much. And I guess that's not much of a surprise. How diverse are they in the way they think? How open in the way they think are they in truth, do you think?
Oh, not at all. I think, you know, they're very much, it's kind of amusing. There's something Monty Python about it, in that everyone really fundamentally has the same beliefs.
Yeah.
And they stem from essentially the same culture. I mean, you really have to look into the fine print to see what's different about them. And yet, you know, there are these deep rivalries. They speak of themselves as kind of, this like a continent of different cultures and practices, and really they're not.
Yeah.
You know, they're quite homogenous, and they all stem from the same tree. They're all branches of the same tree, more or less. But at the same time, over 100 years, and with all these rivalries between the different groups, they've kind of manifested in sort of different ways. But there's something interesting about this, because the language that they're using of diversity and some of the other arguments that they use about, for example, gay marriage, as if gay marriage is possible, why not polygamy? These are all liberal arguments. This is liberal vocabulary. And they can't stand liberals, but they're benefiting from the values that we espouse.
Well, and appealing, you say in the book, to liberal secularists. And of course, there's the irony there that they have their own biases against all kinds of different groups.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, a good case in point for this is the shows Big Love and Sister Wives. When Big Love first started, and this is when I first started kind of exploring polygamy for this book, it was grudgingly accepted amongst fundamentalists that, yes, okay, you know, we've been demonized in the past, but this show is going to humanize us. It's going to show that, you know, we do love our wives and our children and we're just normal families. And Big Love did them enormous service, you know, did fundamentalism as a whole an enormous service in humanizing them. And yet they couldn't stand it. I mean, this is a show. It shows how Hollywood liberals, who were kind of much despised people in this culture, were making life more pleasant for them, even as, you know, they were spitting the word liberal from the side of their mouth.
Sanjiv Bhattacharya is with us. He's the author of the book Secrets and Wives, The Hidden World of Mormon Polygamy. We need to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Sanjiv Bhattacharya. We're talking about his new book. It's called Secrets and Wives, The Hidden World of Mormon Polygamy. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We didn't get Paul from Provo back necessarily, but he did send us the essence of his question. He says that you're looking for this thread that crosses philosophical and cultural ranges, yet you still use the word secret. Paul says you're missing the word sacred. How do you think of the word sacred? How does that fit into the way you're thinking about all of this?
That's an interesting thing to say. Well, you know, I think Paul's sense, I suspect Paul's sense of what the word sacred means, and my sense are probably very different. I tried to address the essence of religious belief and how I approach it in as subjective and personal a way as I possibly could. Right. That was my way of approaching the sacredness of this ground. But, you know, I think sacred is also to some extent a shield as a word. It's supposed to defend a body of beliefs or a religion or a church or something like that from criticism.
Right.
And I very much believe that, you know, churches are open for criticism, especially missionary churches, and that all beliefs have to be placed under scrutiny. Irreverent scrutiny is perfectly legitimate. I think people shouldn't have funny beliefs if they don't want them to be laughed at. You know, there's nothing unhealthy about it. I think this terrible gravity about, you know, these things are sacred, you know, these books are sacred, these words are sacred, is a form of censorship, and it's unnecessary, I think.
Well, isn't that also, doesn't that get to the point you make about let's just legalize it? This idea of it being sacred has been the thing that you say, that like illegality, that the boogeyman that polygamist leaders use to control and terrorize their followers.
Yeah, exactly. Come into the world that we all live in. We all have to put up with the government in our marriage. Why should polygamists be exempt? I mean, I think that sunlight is the best disinfectant. This is a culture with problems, quite evidently. It's very small, and yet it makes the news for all the wrong reasons all the time. So join us. We don't all get to kind of hide and live in privacy. Why should you?
Anne Wilde tells you, and others did as well, that history and doctrine, you've got to understand history and doctrine if you're going to get this life. And so you go digging there, of course, and it's Gary Batchelor, one of the characters in the story, asks if you've read the Book of Mormon. And I wanted to ask you about that and your perceptions of sort of conventional Mormonism as well. Mark Twain called the Book of Mormon chloroform in print. You call it literary ambien. You just couldn't get through it.
No, I couldn't. I couldn't. My knowledge of the Book of Mormon is very much Cliff Notes. Guilty as charged on that front. But my take on this is that life's too short, and there's too much content in the world, and it has to grip you. If it's not gripping, then I'm not going to waste my time with it. I'll take the Cliff Notes. I think it's disingenuous to make the argument that unless you've read the Book of Mormon word for word, you don't understand what the Mormon religion is. I don't think that's right.
Your impressions of Mormonism, really pretty candid. I mean, the story of Mormonism, which you say this in the book, the story of Mormonism, which is almost certainly untrue, not just the small print, the whole thing. And you say it was once a cult and the only one to emerge out of the Second Great Awakening. So your impressions there are very clear and very candid, and I wanted you to talk about that. You also talk about the sense of orderliness as well, and the transformation. I mean, it's more complicated than all of that. But talk about how you were thinking about conventional Mormonism, because, of course, it comes into play in this story.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, I'll be frank. I was, and I am quite a harsh critic of Mormonism. I think once you subject this doctrine to any scrutiny, and the Book of Mormon's version of history to any scrutiny, then it just falls apart. And I really that's not a controversial position, to be honest. Everyone that's not Mormon takes that position. The history of America is just not the one. The Book of Mormon, there's really, if you didn't have faith, you would never believe it. But my impression of Mormons is that I don't hate Mormons. I'm not an anti-Mormon person. If I meet a Mormon, I don't think I don't like you instinctively. It's nothing like that. I fully recognize there are lots and lots of wonderful people in the LDS Church. They do a lot of good in society and all of the rest of it. I just want to make that clear. But the church gives me a great deal of pause. I have reason to be fearful of the church. I think it has changed its spots so many times over its history. Flip-flopping seems to be one of its core principles, and it has many of the kind of aspects of sort of America's character that give, I suppose, foreigners like me hesitation. You know, it's openly ambitious and expansionist. It seems to be obsessed with money and image, and it makes these wild promises to its members that, you know, that in the next life they will have a planet. I mean, talk about the American dream. It has that sort of spirit of American exceptionalism that we're sort of better than everyone else. You know, we're called saints and that sort of thing. And all of this, it builds a gulf between Gentiles like me, who are not saints, who are not going to get a planet, and who aren't really worthy and who can't go to the temple. It's not inclusive, and I feel alienated by it and the way that it behaves. And you know, in a very sort of American spirit, I'm as critical as I can be.
It's interesting. I wondered, reading the book, who you thought was more skeptical, fundamentalists or conventional members of the LDS Church. And we talk about how being an atheist, you say when you're an atheist, people, when you challenge religious faith, you talk about how that's considered arrogant and sporting, but believers are seen as humble. And you talk about meeting this skeptical fundamentalist, and I just wondered who questions things more, do you think, conventional Mormons or fundamentalists?
You know, I don't know if I'm really qualified to answer that question because I didn't write a book about conventional Mormons.
Right.
And I think that would be a very difficult thing to do because there's so many more of them. It's hard to kind of characterize Mormons because they're global and so on, whereas fundamentalists are kind of a little bit easier to get a handle on. But skepticism is an interesting thing. I mean, I think this falls under the bracket of using terminology that just doesn't actually fit the case. In the case of the priesthood elder at Centennial Park, who seemed to be skeptical about lots of things that were in the Bible, you know, the Noah story and so on. At the same time, his sort of orthodoxy reasserted itself at every crucial juncture, you know, that he wasn't left in a position in which doors were open. Ultimately, his faith closed all of the doors around him, and he was secure in his bubble. So I don't think that skepticism, genuine skepticism, is really possible once you've adopted the lifestyle of fundamentalism.
Were you surprised at all the talk about priesthood? It's all about the priesthood with polygamists. You say, who's got it, where it is, who gave it to whom, where did, you know, when was it lost, or how do you get it back? I mean, a kind of obsession with priesthood, I guess.
Yes, it's to me it sounds. I find this part of Mormonism quite amusing because we're talking about something that's phenomenally important and divine and passed down from sort of a creator of worlds and universes from that source. And yet it's so trivial the way in which it's passed on. It's kind of like a playground game in which it's like I liken it to tag in the book, you know, like I lay my hands on you and now you've got the priesthood. And this mystery of like, where's the priesthood? It's kind of like a Dungeons and Dragons thing, like where's the magic sword, you know, who's got the power now? And it's got that, there's something kind of fun about it, you know, that there's a sense that when you have the priesthood, you almost have this kind of superpower. You have like a glow about you that people who don't have the priesthood don't have, and they desperately want. It's turned the very serious business of fundamentalism into something sort of a little bit infantile in a way.
I wanted to ask you about one of the stories. As you look into the Kingston clan, another polygamous group, of course, trying to get invited to this picnic, this big Kingston picnic, which they have every
yes.
July 24th in Bountiful. Bountiful is their home place, I think. Is that how they describe it?
That is, yes.
Tell that story, if you would.
Yes. Well, I mean, I tried to go. They wouldn't let me. They have this picnic. This is my understanding of it: a picnic where members of the order will go, and the most senior and important members, the prophet and so on, will all be there, and they'll have their picnics without any sugar and according to their, you know, lots of oats and things that the order. These are all rules in the order, things that you can and can't eat. And I wanted to join them because I was dying to meet the prophet, Paul Kingston, a figure of like great sort of mystery and darkness. But in the end, I'm not surprised that they didn't let me go. The whole vibe of the order and the Kingston family is one of paranoia, secrecy, and open dissembling, you know. I think in many cases, and these are stories that I tell in the book, they tried to lead me down a certain path away from certain people and stories, which I believe I uncovered nevertheless. And there are some very dark stories within the order. I think the order is a group that needs to be investigated, and I have to say, it's shameful for the Attorney General to have turned a blind eye to the order and their sort of empire of incest that's going on there, as well as many, many other crimes, child brutality. The information is on his desk, and yet nothing has been done. And the order live and work within a 10-minute commute from his office. And I think what's happened with the Warren Jeff story is it really shines a light on Utah's inability to prosecute its own villains, you know. So the order is it's not a subject that lends itself to light conversation. A lot of people are very damaged and physically and mentally by their life in the order, and it's high time something was done, I think.
Let me ask you this finally. Where do you see all of this going? I mean, you talk about, the volcanoes, they burst and, erupt and then sort of subside for a while. What are you, with the Warren Jeffs trial, those other kinds of things, where are you seeing the idea, the sense of polygamy going? Are you seeing a trend? Are you seeing anything in particular now?
Well, Yes, I am. I'm seeing like a broad trend of tolerance towards polygamists increasing, and I welcome that. I think that the path to decriminalization is now possible. It's not a ridiculous notion. And I think that the arguments for decriminalization, which are being made by the family that's representing the Brown family from Sister Wives, there's a lawyer called Jonathan Turley who's making the arguments there, and they want to go to the Supreme Court. That they're probably the most pertinent legal arguments, but I think the actual arguments involve helping the victims of this culture. So I welcome it.
Sandeep Bhattacharya, forgive me. His book is called Secrets and Wives, The Hidden World of Mormon Polygamy. Joined us from a studio in Los Angeles. Thanks very much for the time.
Oh, I appreciate it, Doug. It's a great pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.